from 1 Kings 18, beginning with verse 17. Then it happened, when Ahab saw Elijah, that Ahab said to him, "Is that you, O troubler of Israel?" And he answered, "I have not troubled Israel, but you and your father's house have, in that you have forsaken the commandments of the Lord and followed the Baals. Now therefore send and gather all Israel to me on Mount Carmel, the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah, who eat at Jezebel's table." So Ahab sent for all the children of Israel and gathered the prophets together on Mount Carmel. And Elijah came to the people and said, "How long will you falter between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, follow him." But the people answered him not a word.
I know we've done a series on evolution, and we're going to cover some of the same material, but we're going to add some new things and approach it from a slightly different position. Looking at evolution not as a science, but as a religion. When Paul writes to Timothy the sixth chapter, verse 20, he tells Timothy to guard what has been entrusted to you, talking about the gospel, God's word, his truth, his wisdom, and avoid worldly and empty chatter and the opposing arguments of what is falsely called knowledge. And the King James Version puts in science, which is, if you look up the word science in the dictionary, it'll take you through the old French and the Latin, to the older Latin, where the word science means knowledge. So that's where the word science comes from. It's just, you know, supposedly knowledge. But God warns Timothy and anyone who's a child of God to preserve what is God's wisdom and not to be drawn away by false knowledge or false science. And so that's what we're looking at. One of the greatest deceptions perpetrated by atheists and humanists is that the theory of evolution is somehow science. The reality is that evolution has nothing to do with science, but is merely a tenet of certain false religions opposed to God. Supposedly, I understand that the Supreme Court has viewed evolution as a religion, labeled it such. It's possible, since they've labeled Obamacare as a tax. So in their way of thinking, anything can happen. But if it is true, it is correct, because evolution is a religion. In fact, something like evolution goes back to the times of older Egypt, when it was thought that man was the evolved form of crocodiles that came out of the Nile or something like that. We're going to be looking at, you know, how evolution can be looked at as a religion, or why it's considered a religion. It's an important for Christians to realize that evolution is simply another erroneous belief, and challenge it. That they need not be intimidated into believing that the theory is supported by true science. It is also important that Christians not become suspicious of science, because in many ways it is our ally in helping us to refute false doctrines, false teachings that are out there. And not just because evolutionists and atheists claim falsely that it supports their worldview when it does not. Actually, it supports the Christian view. As kind of perspective of this, Webster defines religion as a cause, a principle, or system of beliefs held to be held with ardor and faith. And that is not only true of Christianity, as we put that in that category, but also false religions and evolution. In Matthew 7, and this is kind of the premise of what we want to get at as a mindset. In Matthew 7, verses 13 through 14, Jesus talks about the two ways. And you can almost get a little picture of it, a little tiny trail going off to one side, which is what God wants people to follow. and a big, broader way that most of the world is going to follow. So as you consider that in this world, do not be swayed by the fact that the majority believe a certain way. In fact, you might even say that's like a death knell for any kind of belief if the majority accepts it. It's better to look to see what God wants us to follow, and even if it is a narrower, smaller trail, we'll be safer if we go down it. A famous event occurred, which Warren read about, almost 3,000 years ago, when Elijah found himself confronting the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of the Asherah. And these false prophets ate at the queen's table. That's what it says. So these were the accepted scientists of the time. These are the ones that everybody thought, okay, this is the accepted way of thinking. These are the accepted gods, especially since, you know, the queen has invited them, so the state recognizes their position. And so Elijah kind of stood up as a sole prophet against over almost a thousand. Of these individuals, you know, going a different way. Although they obviously were wrong, their position and power had so influenced the people that when Elijah stated, if like Warren read, if the Lord is God, follow him, but if Baal, follow him, and the people didn't answer a thing. They just stood there silently. Now, that kind of brings us into contemporary events and situations. Many, if not most, of the people undoubtedly knew that Baal had come from an imagination of men. However, the fact that so many important individuals in their society promoted Baal either caused them to doubt God or be intimidated into silence. A similar situation exists today. Concerted efforts to indoctrinate people through the political realm, through the scientific community, the academia, all sorts of various experts, you know, putting pressure on getting God out of people's thinking. However, polls continuously show that the majority of Americans believe in God, surprisingly. Constantly comes out 70%, 80% of the people asked say, yes, they believe in God, that he is creator, that's how we got here, whatever. While that is good news, the promotion of evolution by many important people in our society likely has caused many of those polled either to doubt God or to be intimidated to the point that they are unwilling to stand firm for God. Now, that's an important point that Christians have to consider, or people that consider themselves Christians. I remember a debate that was going on with a lady by the name of, I think, I can't remember if her first name or last name is Gabriel, but she's a Syrian, now an American. And she's a very ardent opponent or in opposition of Islam. She's seen it wreck her nation, destroy her parents, everything. While she was sitting in a panel, a Muslim girl stood up and questioned, what about all the peaceful Muslims that are in the world? And she went, I mean, it was the wrong question to ask her. I mean, she went through the history, you know, almost on the planet. But, you know, in recent times, she talks about, well, you know, as you look at the Bolshevik revolution, the Bolsheviks were only 80% of the, or 8% of the Russians. The rest of the Russians were irreverent. Thank you. One of those, you know, words, irrelevant. They just stood by and let 8% of the people take over. You know, the Nazi Party was a minority party in Germany. The rest of the Germans, you know, were irreverent. Never mind. Didn't make a difference. Okay, let me put it that way. Because they stood silent. They let it happen. And what Gabriel's point was that it doesn't matter that there's millions of peaceful Muslims on this planet. The violent ones are going to push the movement. And the others are just going to stand by and let it happen, you know, in their silence. And that brings it down to us. It doesn't matter that, you know, 70-80% of Americans believe there's a God if they just stand by and let other changes occur. So if there's going to be a difference, you know, it's going to be from us taking a stand, you know, to stand for God, even if we're like Elijah, the only one doing it. You know, and it's better to be on that narrow road than on the majority road. It's better to have a voice for God than to stand silently against him. This is the main reason it is important to realize that evolution is simply another false religion, and that the temptation people face when confronted with that religion is nothing new. You know, this is why we learn history. Make sure we don't look at the same mistakes or make the same mistakes they've done in the past. When it comes down to interpreting the evidence, the evolutionist has, you know, no solid ground when he looks at, you know, what he considers his support for his theory. In origin science, that is the science that looks at how we got here, you know, where we came from and all that, the interpretation of evidence strongly depends on a person's religious beliefs. The evolutionist looks at exactly the same thing that the creationist does. And the evolutionist goes, okay, well, it looks complicated. That must have evolved that way. You know, it came from something simple and evolved into something complex. The creationist looks at, you know, it couldn't get here without some kind of design and being that complex. They're looking at the same thing. And they come to two different conclusions. And the reason is because both of them are religions in matters of faith. For example, consider the changes that we see in the in life, antibiotic-resistant populations of bacteria. That is, you know, they look at, okay, here's bacteria, we throw antibiotics at it, and they seem resistant to it. And so the conclusion is that, well, there's a new strain that has come around as if evolved from nothing. And they would also look at, you know, through breeding, there's kind of new cats and dogs all the time. They look at, you know, breeding as a form of evolution. That's the way they classify it. Take it on from here. To both the evolutionists and the creationists, these small changes represent microevolution. Yeah. Now, we both agree on this, that microevolution occurs. Both the scientist and the evolutionist and the creationist. We look at it, that's the way God designed things, that things do adapt to the environment. Evolution may be that it has to do with evolution of a species. Where we differ is when it comes to the macroevolution, or the big picture kind of look, where the evolutionist takes it into, well, because things happen on a small scale, they also happen on a big scale. Although there's no proof for it. You know, there's no evidences, no fossil record, no ever, that, you know, things have changed from dinosaurs to bird or apes to ancestor to man. But this is where we vastly differ. Evolutionists believe there is no need for God because in their mind the diversity of life on Earth can be explained by macroevolution, starting with simple life form. In their religious framework, the genetic information needed to produce all the life that we see today developed via macroevolution. This we all know, we've looked at it several times. To a Bible-believing Christian, biological changes are the result of natural selection, mutations, or selective breeding acting on God's original created kinds. You know, that all this can go on, but it has to stay within the boundaries of what God said is the kind. So you don't see cats becoming dogs or anything else. The genetic information needed to produce the variety of life we see today was present in the original created kinds, put there by God in the original perfected or perfect creation. A century ago, it would have been difficult to take the discussion further. You know, we'd argue back and forth and there'd be no clear oversight. However, advances in science and technology have actually fallen to the side of the creationist and confirm the physical and analytical evidence strongly favors the Christian framework. For example, every observable instance of the bacteria developing resistance to antibiotics has been traced to one of three organisms. Those would be that as they were looking at the bacteria, what happened was the ones that seemed to be resistant to antibiotics, they weren't something new. They were something that were kind of recessive or in the background, and they became dominant, you know, when the others dropped out. Okay? Or the second mechanism is that there were some that had the resistance, but they were neutral themselves and passed it on to a plasmid transfer to another strain that could receive it and became resistant to antibiotics. You know, the third system is that some, either that last category took off or that they developed a mutation, and we believe in mutations, but we also know that no mutation has ever, you know, come up with something that's beneficial. And so in those three categories, the conclusion is in all cases, genetic information is neither conserved nor lost. It's like energy. Nothing new. Nothing created out of nothing. In no case do we observe new information being generated, that is, new genetic code coming up in the bacteria to create a new bacteria. You know, it's always the same old bacteria that's been there. We know this now, which is required for macroevolution to be even theoretically possible. Our scientific knowledge of bacteria is totally consistent with the Genesis account. In no way does that scientific knowledge support evolutionists seeking to explain how vast amounts of new genetic information can be generated through random mutations. Okay? The science isn't there for new generations, for information even coming out of nothing. Information increasing mutations have not been observed. None of the examples provided in the most popular biology textbooks support the premise that evolution of life occurs by information increase. Another topic where the interpretation of evidence is influenced strongly by one's religious beliefs is homogeneous and analogous structures. Homologous, or whatever, the analogous structures, are structures in different species that are similar. This is an old textbook showing that it seems like since the fetus in a lot of animals and in the human look alike, or the fetus looks like a little tadpole or something like that, where they, you know, is that we have a common ancestor. So it's just because structures are similar. Like in the sense of a typical examples of the structure of a bird wing and an arm and a dolphin fin are structures that are similar. Now, how do you account for that? You know, why does my arm look like a bird's wing? Minus the feathers, I guess. To the Christian, these structures are structures that differ in different species are similar because God created them all. That is, God put us in a system. You know, we're carbon-based life forms. We have gravity. We have a certain environment. And some systems work. Some mechanisms work. And so they're similar in design. But a man can't fly. So the wing structure in his arm is absolutely useless. Talk to Icarus because of that. On the other case, to the evolutionists, these wings, fins, and arms are not similar because God designed all three, but because they have common ancestors. So we would say, as Christians, that if you look at things out there that have wheels, bicycles, motor cars, airplanes, the Christian would say that's because we're in a similar environment, we have similar designers. Okay, and so in many cases, you're going to find the wheel showing up, whereas the evolutionists would say that they all came from a tricycle and evolved. Okay. The argument is that rudimentary and that too simple and almost ludicrous. Neither statement, though, has a scientific basis. They're beliefs based on one's viewpoint or worldview. When we consider like creation in itself of life, the beginning of it, origins, how the whole system got here is not a scientific or subject to scientific experiment. This thing on. Yeah. It is a matter, if nothing else, of history and a belief system, a faith. Say history because do you believe that Abraham Lincoln existed? Can you prove it in the science lab? No. It's not subject to science. You can't put it in a test tube. You can't recreate Abraham Lincoln to show that it's possible. It's something that's proved by historical documentation and evidence. Eyewitness accounts, photographs that were taken, whatever, works that he's put out there, writings, speeches and things. So it's a whole different realm. And that's where creation belongs, and also evolution. But only the atheist interpretation is given in the five biological textbooks. So only their viewpoint gets out there to young minds. Now, one criterion for determining if a theory is scientific is if it can be constructed in a way that an experiment could be devised to prove it false. I had to wrap my mind around that. It's only scientific if you can come up with a way to prove that it doesn't exist or didn't happen that way. All it's asking you is, can you come up with something that one way or the other can prove that this is the way it happened or this is the way it didn't happen? If you can't, then you're kind of in the same category as a witch doctor or shaman who goes, I made it rain the other day. Or if it didn't rain, you didn't pay me enough. How do you prove that one way or the other? You can't come up with a system. Now, how would you prove that? I recall Amazing Randy came up with a technique of how to prove whether water diviners knew what they're doing or not. The water diviner guys that get out there with a little witching rod, and they walk the ground, and when the thing goes down, they'll tell you there's water underneath. That works because most water is found in water tables. Very few water runs in little rivers under the ground, whatever. So if your neighbor's got water, chances are you do too, if you're living in a little valley. But he devised a way to try to test these guys. And so what he did was built a tank of water, and he ran some pipes down underground, just under the surface. He ran them in different places so he knew where they were and covered it with earth, and call the best water diviners in the world to come out and do their thing over the pipes and put little flags where they thought the water was. I mean, that's a way you can test whether these guys really know what they're doing. In fact, he said none of them were even close, but he said that the weirdest thing about the experiment is that at the end of it, the last guy to go out, you could hear the water running out of the tank, glug, 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 emptying so that there was nothing water running through the pipes. If the guy had been aware enough of his surroundings, he would have known that the test would not work with him. But he went out there and put his little flags out and micro moved them and everything else to tell us where the water was. So if you can come up with a test for something to prove either it's legitimate or not, then it's science. But if you can't do that, then you're in a realm of witch doctors. And that's where evolution kind of belongs. Another area where the religious nature of the theory of evolution can be seen is the discussion of the origin of life. From a Christian perspective, the Bible tells us how life was created and during the week of creation, and life is evidence of God's handiwork. In contrast, The humanist and atheist religions require that the existence of life somehow be explained without God. In the 21st century, that's this century, most humanists and atheists have chosen to put their faith in the theory of evolution. When the theory of evolution was being popularized in the late 1800s, it was easy to speculate like life from nothing, getting something. They called it spontaneous generation. In fact, even as Darwin was proposing, that's what evolution was, because of the evident experiment. You leave meat out, and suddenly you find maggots on it. So that spontaneous generation was, that the dead meat actually produced living maggots. And so that was part of Darwin's concept that he was drawing from. In fact, the head of the French Academy of Science boastfully claimed that he could produce life from nothing because of this kind of existence that people looked at the world around them. He said, I can leave out meat, I can leave out vegetables, I can leave out dairy products, and in a couple of days you'll see life from nothing. Now, at that period of time, it was easy to kind of fool people into believing into evolution. But what was happening at the same time, the last part of the 1800s into the 1900s, was a man who was working in the background and had to struggle against some opinions, and his name was Pasteur, a legitimate scientist. And he was taking the meat and he was sterilizing it and he was putting it in vacuum and finding that there's no maggots that appear. If you're not exposing it to the air where flies can land on and lay eggs and all this kind of stuff, it doesn't happen. And it wasn't soon after his experiments that it was pretty much debunked that spontaneous generation can occur. So they don't use those terms anymore. Now they use the term punctuated equilibrium. And the teachers will get there and they'll use little crickets and they'll say, see, you go along and there's no life, and then click, click, life occurs out of nothing or just happens. So spontaneous generation, we know, is scientifically proven to be bogus, but you rename it and you can revive it. Leading evolutionists freely speculate or even fabricated evidence in support of their religion. However, advances in science have shown that these speculations and fabrications are nonsense. For example, we now know that the simplest life form is far more complex than any humans have ever made. That is, our concept of the beginning life forms, the single cells and stuff, used to be thought of almost like the atom. A very simple little something that the Greeks conceived of as the building block of life. We now know, as you start breaking down the atom, it's got positive charges in it, negative charges, and neutral charges, and then there's subatomic particles, and there's quarks, and there's nuons and muons, and all sorts of little things that start spitting off into the little clouds that we can't even observe. In fact, Enrico Fermi, when he got his atom smasher all built and started breaking up the atom into smaller things, and people thought we'd have the answer to the secret of life. And they asked him, does your atom smasher unfold the secrets of the universe? And his answer was, no, it's just brought up more questions. In fact, it is far more reasonable to claim that the space shuttle can randomly assemble and launch itself than to claim that a simple life form can occur. We know that about simple life forms now. They are far more complicated than the space shuttle. And in their formation, there are various things within it, the outer wall that has to protect the inner stuff, and the inner stuff that creates the outer wall. So it cannot be just formed at random. It's very specifically designed and incredibly created. Like we pointed out, it's like if you had a blueprint of a house, You know, if you had a blueprint that not only tell you where it's going, you know, on a structure, but actually provided the materials and built the house, and if there's any damage done to it, it would rebuild that the damaged part. That's what a cell does, even the simplest ones. Someone just speculated, was the lottery? You know, the lottery is way up there, and the person who ever wins the lottery is going to be the first billionaire, made by the lottery. But the odds of somebody winning the lottery are the same as they said a woman having triplets. I'll give you another sample. The odds of simple cells forming by random chance out of nothing are the same odds of me having triplets. Yeah, it isn't going to happen. Yeah. In fact, this is what it gets in response. Many evolutionists, textbooks or whatever, bring out the Miller-Urey experiment, you know, that life is created in a test tube and whatever. However, these so-called building blocks are no closer to having a living organism than the atoms they comprise. Now, here's, I've shown you another example. This one I got a recent drawing off the internet. And if you look at it, it's a reconstruction, supposedly, of the Stanley Miller concept of what the early Earth looked like. And in a boiling flask, they put certain elements, which is supposed to be what the Earth's crust looked like, boiling away under a hot Earth. And then whatever is generated from that, they put it into a vacuum system. But they run it over into a sort of flask with electrodes, and to generate a spark like lightning that happened in the clouds in an atmosphere of methane and ammonia and hydrogen and water or whatever. And that then begins to condense into amino acids. And that's what they do. They draw off the amino acids to show everybody, see, we've got the building blocks of life. Well, amino acids are only part of it in the simplest part. But the whole thing that's stupid about this experiment is that it's bogus. The very fact that there's a trap there, or a spigot or whatever I've seen on it, is that they're draining off the amino acids before they have time to get back into the the boiling flask. And that's what people's contentions were. That's one of the contentions, is that if you let this system run and those things rain back into that boiling earth, those amino acids would be destroyed faster than they're made. Now, there's other things that scientists found that were a problem with this. In fact, this was one of the things I pointed out to my biology teacher in my term paper. I said, I showed him all the problems with this, experiment. And he goes, well, there's other experiments that they did to show you get life. Okay, here was my question to him that kind of shut him up. I said, yeah, but this one's the one that was in the textbook, so I figured it's your best shot. Okay, so Stanley Miller and Harold Urey recreated the early atmosphere by mixing these chemicals together, passing the electric arc, and showing that organic compounds could form spontaneously. The results of this experiment were spectacular and exceeded Miller and Urey's wildest dreams. Now, by evoking the emotion, wildest dreams, and selectively presenting only a very small subset of the relevant information, the student is effectively misled. Is that science? Hyping the experiment and leaving the information, some information out of it. Most textbooks fail to mention that telling. Consider a few examples. Even most evolutionists now agree that the atmosphere simulated by the Miller-Urey could not have existed. Ammonia and methane would have been destroyed by ultraviolet light, and hydrogen would have been present only in very small amounts because it's lighter, in air than pulls away from gravity and would have gone into the upper atmosphere. Many famous evolutionists have calculated the odds of a cell, or even just the proteins in a cell randomly assembling, these odds, again, calculated by evolutionists themselves, so discredit the theory that they typically are not mentioned in discussions of the topic. So the evolutionists know the numbers of what the odds are of these things happening. Statisticians don't agree with evolution at all because they work the numbers. When I was writing my paper, I was also taking a statistics class. And two of the things I drew from the statistics textbook were what it was like for evolution to come about. And they likened it to a whirlwind going through a junkyard and assembling a jumbo jet, or a monkey typing on a typewriter and coming out with an entire set of Encyclopedia Britannica. the numbers are astronomical. And so anybody that's seen the numbers doesn't believe in the theories. Or they have a faith that causes them to reject information. And this is why evolution is a religion. The suppression of evidence against the theory of evolution is not limited to the discussion of this experiment, but those discussions are revealing. And objective scientists, obtains and considers all available evidence. You have to prove what's going on. The demonstrated desire of evolutionists to suppress or ignore evidence that contradicts an atheistic worldview provides yet another example of how evolution is religion and not science. Just as in false religions, people reject facts all the time. Now, this is the last slide, and we're out of here. I want you to notice something about this presentation. Like I said, parts of it draw from things I've already covered before. But the reason I gave you this presentation and kind of the way it's presented is because who came up with it? In fact, I can show you the Apologetics Press video of this individual. His name is Dr. Houts, and these are his credentials. He holds a PhD in nuclear engineering from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. His professional activities include serving as a chairman of the Symposium on Space Nuclear Power and Propulsion. He was employed by Los Alamos National Laboratory for 11 years, serving in various positions, including deputy group leader. He presently is the nuclear research manager for NASA. He says evolution is bogus. He's a scientist, a very well-respected scientist. And there's a lot of them out there. Unfortunately, there's a lot of them, like our Christian example, where they're intimidated by academia, by the universities, by other places, and they just keep silent. This guy doesn't. And there's others like him. Okay, so you don't have to be afraid or intimidated for being a Christian and sticking up for creation theory. Okay, it's your world belief, and there's more in science to back it up than there is in evolution. And this is one of the confidences that God will continually give us. And this is what you have to have faith in. And it's been shown to be truth. This is why your faith is more solid than that of the evolutionist. As life goes on, as time goes on, and people keep digging in the earth, the archaeologists and the scientists keep experimenting and finding new things on every level, either in astronomy or in astrophysics or in the more biological, microbiological areas, more and more proofs are constantly coming out for God and creation. Okay, God has proven himself that he knows more about what's going on than the most advanced minds that ever lived. And most of those advanced minds pass away and nobody even remembers them. But God has been around for 6,000 years and he's going nowhere. And he'll constantly be working in your life, not only to demonstrate to you that he exists in the sense of proofs that can be offered, but when one gets to really know God and understand him and get to approach him more in prayer and can open their eyes to see that God is working in their lives, changing things, working things, what we covered in our little class this morning, Romans 8:28. This is what the Christian has over the rest of the world. This is what we have as a confidence that nobody else does. As we look at the world and all the things that are in it, and you look at the news and the bad things going on, and you feel that everything's going downhill, Paul says that as the Christian, we know that God causes all things to work together for good. All things being whatever the bad things men do, whatever the good things men do, God is going to use it all to work together for good, for those that love God, for those that are called according to His purpose. So for the Christian to understand that my whole duty here is to fear God and keep His commandments, I know as I work that in my life, make that my purpose and goal, that the power of God is going to be behind me, working also to achieve the things that need to be worked. I mean, this is what we're just seeing. God working things that we have the proof, the evidence, and the power displayed of Him in this world and working things for us. One of the other things I pointed out to the kids was Isaiah 45:11, where God said, "Ask me about the things concerning my people, and you will commit me to the work of my hands." What does the future hold? If I tell you, it will happen because I will make it happen. We can pray for things. This is why prayer works. If God has promised to answer our prayers, He can make it happen. He's that powerful. It doesn't matter what men do, the decisions they make, the wars they cause, or the good things they build. God will use it all for you if you're one of His people. And that's our invitation. If you like that as your advantage in this world, now is the time to come. Now, present yourself to God and serve Him faithfully for the rest of your life. And that includes this life and the one to come. Won't you come as we stand to sing?